Regulations, oh boy. It's a lot of regulations.
The head people, they're petrified of the regulators. They're petrified. They can't move. The regulators are running the banks. So we're going to do a very major haircut on Dodd-Frank.
We have some of the bankers here. There's nobody better to tell me about Dodd-Frank than Jamie, so you're going to tell me about it. But we expect to be cutting a lot out of Dodd-Frank because, frankly, I have so many people, friends of mine, that have nice businesses. They can't borrow money. They just can't get any money because the banks just won't let them borrow because of the rules and regulations in Dodd-Frank. So we'll be talking about that here in terms of the banking industry.
Nothing But the Truth podcast. We are your hosts, Kelly Richmond Pope
and Tim Edson.
In any industry, there can be many forms of fraud, corruption, and whistleblowers. The violator and the violated. The guilty and the innocent. On this podcast, we want you to hear the truth, where you might find yourself experiencing different feelings and emotions towards these stories that fall on either side of the line, or maybe even on the line. We'll be bringing you a variety of stories told directly from the sources, whether they committed the fraud, were forced to commit the fraud, and even those who blew the whistle on their employers that were wrongfully accused. So, Tim, another podcast episode, right?
Yeah, and this time we're talking about banks.
You love the banks, don't you?
Oh, I love it. I love paying so much debt to the banks and,
Well, I'll tell you what happened. This was year before last. Hold on. I think it was last year. I wrote this article for my Forbes blog, and it was entitled Wells Fargo and Millennial Whistleblowing. What do we tell them? Because I was following the story and I noticed that the people that actually tried to blow the whistle on what was happening at Wells Fargo got fired. And so I was thinking, how do I tell my students to come forward and blow the whistle when they could potentially get fired? And I posted this article to my Forbes blog, and this woman responds by saying, I used to be a Wells Fargo employee, and she shared a little bit of her story. So I tracked her down and found her on Facebook and connected with her via Facebook Messenger. And her name is Lynn. We'll just say Lynn, because I don't know if Lynn wants her full identity disclosed. But Lynn had a really interesting experience sharing what it was like being on the ground level of the Wells Fargo fraud.
Yeah, that's great, because Wells Fargo, as we know, if you pay attention to the news, Wells Fargo has been in the news quite often recently for exactly these reasons of what Lynn has to say. So,
but it's interesting. I mean, because this, you're going to have a lot of different emotions as you hear from her experience, and you really get into her story and almost think about what would you do if it was you? You know, when you see something wrong, do we immediately just step up and say it? Or do we think about, well, what if we do say it and then we get blamed? And that's what I like about this episode, because it really forces you to think about being in Lynn's shoes. Being in Lynn's shoes at a Wells Fargo branch, really, what was it like? And you'll hear that in this episode.
Yeah, I'm anxious to hear the story. I want to hear what kind of route she took, the retaliation Wells Fargo had, and what kind of treatment she had from Wells Fargo, like how they reacted and everything. It's going to be interesting to hear this.
Right. Matter of fact, there was an interesting article that was in the New York Times, that was on CNN and Apple News. And this one that I'm referring to is the Federal Reserve's response to Wells Fargo. And the headline is, the Federal Reserve cracks down on Wells Fargo over scandal involving sham accounts. And so on February 2nd, the Federal Reserve levied an unprecedented penalty against Wells Fargo on Friday, ordering the mega bank to oust four of its board members and not grow any bigger until it corrects the governance problems that led to this huge fraud. And so Lynn really gives us some insight into what the governance problems truly were. And it's just a fascinating story.
Yeah, I'm curious on how serious the feds are going to take this. Like, how far is this going to go? Is there going to be any penalty to Wells Fargo besides what they've, you know, besides just restricting them from doing any kind of trading and whatnot? But is this just a temporary thing? I'm curious on how far this is going to go. So yeah, I can't wait to hear what Lynn has to say in this story coming up, being an insider and all.
And when you read about this, you know, I'm just reading this article and it's saying that the bank's problem stemmed from its admission in 2016 that it had opened millions of sham accounts that customers didn't ask for. And so Lynn provides some insight as to what that experience was like in her branch. And as we've learned, some customers were wrongly charged with overdraft and other fees that harmed their credit scores. Do you know anybody that was impacted by this? Did you have an account at Wells Fargo?
I have a student loan, but my credit isn't the greatest because of my student loan. So they're going to have a hard time trying to open up a credit card under my name.
Well, we hope you all will enjoy this episode and take a listen and join us at the end.
I started working for Wells Fargo. Actually, I started working for Wachovia about 2006. I started out as a banker. Back then they were called CSSRs. So I started out as a customer service representative. And I did that for a couple of years. And then I became a service manager, which is the teller, like the lead teller manager. Basically, we're in charge of the teller line, making sure everybody got their breaks and making sure the money was right. So I did that for a very, very long time. And then Wells Fargo took over in 2011. So I did stay with the company. We weren't really given any notice. We knew that the bank was going to get bought out, but there was a couple of other perspectives. I think Capital One was one of them. So we didn't find out until the day of merger that we were going to be Wells Fargo. So we walked into the bank and there's a whole bunch of people there in red shirts and we're just like, oh, okay. So I stayed with the bank and I worked in many different branches throughout New Jersey. I started out in Highland Park and I was transferred to Toms River. I worked in the Carteret branch. So I helped out in a lot of different locations. I was actually training to be promoted to a market support consultant. It's a role that works directly with all the other service managers in a specific region to help to keep them updated on changes and to do audits and things of the such. So I was training to do that, and then Hurricane Sandy hit, and unfortunately our home was basically destroyed. We didn't really have anywhere to live, and we're staying with family and friends for quite a while. And I had a family member that lived down here in Virginia that was like, hey, why don't you just move down here? You know, we could help you find a place and everything. And I thought that was great. So I applied for a transfer in 2013. I believe it was July. And my transfer was approved for me to start working down here in Virginia on September 1st of 2013. The first day that I walked into my branch, I was told that two of the bankers had quit, three tellers had quit, and that the actual branch manager was on FMLA. And that I would be basically running this branch shorthanded by myself with a team of people I didn't even know until further notice. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So I started work that day, and I ended up working predominantly as a teller because we didn't have enough coverage and it was a higher level branch. It was right across the street from a mall. So a lot of merchants came in to get change and to do deposits and it was just very, very busy all throughout the day. It's in Chesapeake, Virginia. It was a large area. There's just a lot of strip malls and stuff. So most of my day I was working as a teller. So it was really hard for me to get my other tasks done. But when I did find time, I usually worked like from 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 or 8 o'clock at night. I would stay and run some reports and try to get some of my actual jobs, like what I'm supposed to be doing, done. So It was around September 23rd of 2013. I did a report through, they had a back office type system. It was called the Dark Side. It's called Hogan. And in that Hogan server, you can do all kinds of strange reports that you can't do in their actual reporting system. And I was getting a couple of customer complaints where customers would come in and say that they were being emailed debit cards that they didn't request and things of the such. So I decided to run a duplicate social security number report. So this report, when you run it through Hogan, it'll find a whole bunch of accounts that are linked to the same social security number. So when I ran that report, which should have had nothing in it, it was actually a very, very large file. And the file was so large that it froze my computer, and I couldn't even see past the first page of this report. And I was just, like, baffled, because I've never seen so many things come up on this report before. So a lot of the, when the report pops up, it shows you the last four digits of the social, and then it'll show you the address that's linked to the social and dates that accounts were open. And it's typically in social security number order, but you could change the order. But as I'm looking at the screen, a lot of the addresses were the same. So I logged out of that computer and logged into a different one because it was frozen. And I decided to do a duplicate address search. And I searched the branch address. And when I searched the branch address, there was over, I think, 1,500 accounts that were found with the branch address. And there shouldn't be more than a handful of accounts at that branch, because each branch has, like, a petty cash fund and things like that. Well, these were credit cards and debit cards and checking accounts, and none of those things should have been linked to the branch address. So I started writing down the account numbers that were linked and looking them up in SBC, which is what the bankers use to open accounts. And I started pulling them up and printing them, because I was just like, what is going on? So a lot of these accounts had the same social security number. All of these accounts, what they had in common was they all used the branch address. So if a debit card was to be ordered or a credit card was to be ordered, essentially it would be mailed to the branch and not to the customer. I contacted Ethics on September 23rd of 2013, and I let them know what I found. And I reported 150 fake accounts that day, because none of them were ever funded. None of them had money in them. None of them had ever been used. But they were under social security numbers that did exist. I just didn't know the people's real names, because they were under, like, Jane Doe, or I think one of them that I printed was under an Ashley Williams. You know, there's just strange, you know, like, common names just being put in there, just so that people could get their bonuses. So I reported it to Ethics on September 23rd, and I let them know, you know, all these accounts that I found, and they asked me to send an email to them with a zip file with all the accounts, and that they would begin an investigation, which I was like, great. About 4 days goes by, it was about a week, and the district manager comes into the branch and asks to speak with me. So we went into, there was like a kitchen area in the back of the branch, and she proceeds to tell me that she did not transfer me from 300 miles away to cause issues in her district, that her district is now under investigation because I'm nosy, that I should really learn to mind my business and just do what my job at hand is, and to leave her salespeople alone. And I was just completely baffled by the whole conversation, and I just said, okay, I'm sorry, whatever, you know, just to get out of there. I was actually very confused, because the call that I provided to Ethics was anonymous. I never provided my name. And for it to end up in my employee file, which it is there, because the lawyers that are currently suing Wells Fargo for the retaliation, they were able to get a copy of my employee file. And that anonymous call is in my employee file, and it should have never ended up there. When you call Ethics anonymously, even when you provide your name, none of that information is supposed to be shared on your employee file at all. And all the district managers and the branch managers have access to these employee files. So when you log in under, like, I was a service manager, so I had access to all my teller's employee files. So I could log in to ePro, which is like Oracle. That's what they use to keep all the employee files. I could log in there and choose a name anywhere in my tellers and look at all their employee records, all the times they've been written up, all the times that whether they quit before and was rehired, fired people, whether they're rehirable, all of that information's there. So I was very, very concerned as to why an anonymous call ended up on my employee file, why this woman was even able to access it, how could she have ever possibly known that I was the one who called, and even if she did find out I was the one who called, how could she have the audacity to actually come to the branch and reprimand me for doing my job? Even if one of my tellers would have called, I would never have expected a higher-up to come and reprimand that person for doing the right thing, because they have you watch these training videos every year on ethics, and they tell you, if you see something, say something. You know, if you witness it or if you find it, let someone know. And I did just that. I called, and I did the right thing, and now I'm being belittled and yelled at. I was just very confused and concerned, like, what is going on, you know? It just didn't make any sense to me. So I just wanted to get out of that room because she was being very nasty. You know, she was not a very nice person, and she was very aggravated that I had made this phone call, and she said, you know, she was going to lose her bonus over this and all this stuff, and I just wanted to get out of there. So I pretty much said whatever she needed to hear to get her to leave me alone, and I walked out of that room and just kind of put my head in the dirt. I was like, all right, this is not going to be a great situation for me. And I was right. It was 2 days later, her and the MSC came in and wrote me up for not maintaining proper night drop logs. And it was a log that we didn't use in New Jersey that nobody had even showed me it existed, because I didn't get any proper training when I was transferred down here. They did things a lot different down here because New Jersey was a pilot state. We did everything digitally. Where down here, they were actually keeping physical, like, handwritten logs. So a lot of these things I had no idea existed. And when they threw me into this branch, they never provided, like, a lead teller. There was no lead teller. That woman had quit prior to me even coming down here. So there was nobody there to say, hey, look, you know, let me stick by your side. Let me show you how to do this or do that. They were kind of just like, hey, you know, here's the branch. Good luck. Here's the keys. Have a great day. And they all left. So they wrote me up for not maintaining proper logs. Well, it was not actually a write-up at that point. It was a warning. During this warning, I wrote down how I feel I could change that behavior or whatever. So I wrote down on the form that, you know, somebody coming and properly training me on the different types of logs, there's various logs that are used there that I'm not familiar with, you know, would definitely help to prevent any further situations where a log wasn't being maintained properly. So they agreed that they would have somebody come, and nobody ever came. In the meantime, I'm still trying to figure out how to do things I'm supposed to be doing while operating as a teller 8 hours a day and trying to keep, you know, cash ordered. And, you know, so I'm kind of being thrown all over the place. I never got a lunch break. I couldn't leave the branch. I was the only person with override authority. So I couldn't even, you know, step away for 15 minutes because if somebody needed an override and I wasn't there, they would have to come looking for me. I was lucky if I got to use the bathroom, you know, because I couldn't go far. When they wrote me up that day, well, when they gave me the formal warning that day, and I had explained, you know, that we're extremely understaffed, I don't have the necessary tools that I need to do my job successfully. They were very apprehensive to that, and they were like, well, you've been working for this company for long enough to figure it out. And I'm like, yeah, well, I also work in a pilot seat, and we did everything digitally, where if you scan something, there was already a paper trail without you having to print a piece of paper at all. You know, it was there. And here, everything is paper, and I'm not aware of these logs. So they kind of used that against me. And anything that they could find, any reason they could find, like the mailman had came in one day and left mail in a banker office that nobody used, and they wrote me up for that because I didn't see him put the mail in there, and I didn't go get the mail. And mind you, it was a magazine and some advertisements. It wasn't even anything important. But they gave me a formal warning for not maintaining the mail that comes in and out of the branch. Yeah, so this went on until October, around the 13th. I was on vacation from the week of the 15th because my godmother, I'd already planned vacation, but my godmother ended up passing away that same week. The Friday that I found out that she passed away, I went into the branch and I let everybody know, hey, look, I'm going to New Jersey next week for a funeral. So if you guys need to be in touch with me Monday, I may not be able to answer the phone because her memorial service was Monday. She was cremated, so there wasn't an actual, like, funeral, but, you know, her memorial service was Monday. So I let them all know, you know, if you need anybody, you're going to have to contact Joy Samethy. She's going to be the only person who could help you because I might not be able to answer the phone. And they were just like, okay, whatever, you know. I left to go to New Jersey. I had my daughter with me, who at the time was 7 or 8 years old. And it was October, I believe October 15th was the date, because it was also my birthday. And they called me around, it was 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The day of the memorial service, I get a phone call, and I actually recorded this phone call so that they couldn't say that I lied or something, because I already knew what was going to happen. And it was the MRC who called me. She gets on the phone and she starts screaming at me, stating that I didn't leave any ATM keys with anybody there. And mind you, the way the bank works, when keys are assigned to you, they are your keys. You go home with them. Like, they are, it's just like having your car key. You don't just give your car key to somebody else. You know, you keep that with you 24/7. So she tried telling me that I should have left my ATM key there for someone else to use. Because there was no other ATM keys that worked in the branch, which was ridiculous because I wasn't the only person accessing the ATM, so there was definitely another ATM key there that could have been used. But she screamed at me and told me that I had to either overnight FedEx the key back or come back myself and assign a key out this way people could access the ATM while I'm gone. So I was like, okay, you know, I'll come back, I'll drive home tonight, and I'll be there tomorrow morning to provide a key. So that's the only thing I said. She was screaming and yelling, and she even, like, said, don't get it twisted. You know your job. Like, it was just, it was pretty bad. Like, I was on the phone crying. I'm on a memorial service crying, not because my godmother died, but because I'm being screamed at on the phone by a higher-up at my job. So, yeah, it was a pretty sick call. So I got off the phone with this woman, and I finished up at the memorial service, and me and my 8-year-old daughter drove all the way back down to Virginia, about a 6-hour drive. And we got there first thing in the morning. It was 9 o'clock. The branch had just opened and there was no customers there or anything. And mind you, I was on the phone with HR before I even walked in the branch to let them know, hey, this is what happened. I was in touch with them through email and everything throughout this whole process. So HR knew. So I walked into the branch and there's no management there, except for this girl who worked at a different branch, and she was, I believe she was a branch manager for a different local branch. And she ended up getting fired because a lot of the fake accounts that I found came from her branch, so she ended up being terminated, like, quickly after this, after the investigation was over. Her name was Annie. So I walk into the branch, and I'm like, hey, they said that you guys needed an ATM key. I'm just here to assign a key. And Annie's like, oh, no, they have a key. They're fine. And I'm like, well, how come nobody called me? Like, I just drove from New Jersey all the way down here to give you guys a key. And she goes, oh, I don't know why they didn't call you, but we have a key. Okay. So I'm turning around with my daughter to leave. She was like, oh, wait, you can't leave yet. You have to call Joyce, the MSC. Well, I'm on vacation. Like, I'm not even supposed to be here. Like, I'm not calling her today. And she was like, well, Joyce said that you cannot leave until you call her. Okay, this is ridiculous, and at this point, I was about to quit. Like, I was just over it. So I was like, look, I'm just going to give you all my keys and leave. And then this woman, Janet, who was actually one of my tellers, she was like, Lynn, don't do that. Don't do that. It's not worth it. Just call her, see what she wants. She's like, I could sit here in the office with you if you want. All right. So I go into the office. My daughter's in the office with me, and I get Joyce on the phone. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm here. I came to bring the key. They said they already had one. You know, I just wish somebody would have told me. She goes, well, we don't have to check in with you. If you wanted to know whether or not they had a key, you should have called there first. Well, you called me yesterday while I was at a memorial service to tell me they had no key and to tell me to get my ASS back here to give them a key that now they're saying they don't even need. And she was like, oh, well, you got it twisted. I didn't tell you that. I told you just to mail it. I'm like, whatever. I'm like, yeah, you're right. You're right. I got to go. And I hung up on her and I got up and left. So my daughter was crying. She was very, very upset. She started crying when they told us we couldn't leave. So my daughter's just sitting there and she's hysterical. And she still remembers this to this day. She's 11 now and she still remembers this. So I'm trying to get my daughter to leave. And they just kept like asking me questions. They're like, well, what did Joy say? And I'm like, it doesn't matter. I got to go. I'm on vacation. I'll see you guys next week. While I was on vacation, the manager who was supposed to be out on FMLA came in with another banker, and they went through my desk, and they, like, kind of tore it up. Like, nothing was in the same spot it was before. I came back to work. They had audited my cash box, like, behind my back. Like, I had no clue any of this was happening. And cash boxes are allowed to be audited in dual control, which is fine. But when you have two people auditing your cash box who have malicious intent, it's not fine. So I came back to work, and that's when I found out that somebody had been in my desk, and there was pictures of my daughter that I had in my desk that were missing. And one of them had, like, some kind of tape stuck to it, and they were, like, her school pictures. So I texted the manager who was on FMLA, because everybody told me, you know, she was the one who was in my desk. And all I texted her was, hey, I know that you went into my desk. That's fine. Could you just tell me where my daughter's pictures are? Well, instead of her texting someone else, I don't know who she intended to text. I'm assuming it's the district manager. She accidentally texted me back that I was at the branch causing an issue, causing a big scene, and that somebody should go there and terminate me immediately. Mind you, I was not causing a scene. I just texted her and asked her where the pictures were. So I accidentally get this text message that she intended to send to someone else, and I read it, and I just start giggling because I'm like, this is just silly. So I text her back, and I'm like, Darlene, I'm not causing a scene. I was just wondering if you saw the pictures that were in my desk, because all I care about is getting my pictures. And I have that all screenshotted. And she replies, oh, I'm sorry, not a big deal, don't worry about it, basically. So I didn't even tell anybody the pictures were missing. I just contacted her directly. So I contact HR, and I forward those text messages to HR, because I'm like, this is just ridiculous. Like, I wasn't causing a scene. Nobody was trying to get anybody in trouble. I was just legitimately looking for the pictures. Because as of this point, I had started packing up my desk, because I was quitting. I was done. So the reason why I was looking for the pictures is because I had brought a box to work with me, and I was putting all my personal items in the box. So a day or two goes by, and the manager who's supposed to be on FMLA and the district manager come in, and they had written me up because they were trying to say that I had debit cards in my desk from New Jersey. And I was like, it's not even possible, because the debit cards get audited twice a month. I'd already been in Virginia for over a month. So if I had debit cards that belonged to New Jersey in my desk, the manager from New Jersey would have called me and said, hey, I think you accidentally brought some cards with you. I didn't have any cards. I did a whole debit card audit before I left New Jersey, before I left that branch, to ensure that everything that was in my name was moved over back to the branch. So I knew I had nothing. I didn't have a key on me, nothing that belonged to New Jersey. So they tried to write me up for that. I refused to sign the write-up. And I called the manager in New Jersey, who I'm still good friends with today. And I said, hey, Jerry, is your branch missing any debit cards? Because they're trying to write me up for having debit cards in my desk that are supposed to belong to your branch. And he goes, hold on a second. And he pulls up the debit card audit. He goes, we just did an audit 2 days ago. The debit cards are fine. So he emailed me a copy of the debit card audit proving that all their cards were intact, that they had every single one, and that I didn't have any. So I forwarded that to HR. And I'm like, look, they're trying to write me up saying that I had cards in my desk that I didn't have, obviously. They refused to show me any cards because I asked them. I was like, well, show me the cards. And they're like, oh, well, we'll show them to you at a later time. We don't have them right now. And I'm like, okay. I explained all this to HR, and they said that they would talk to the district manager and the branch manager and see what was going on. And they never got back to me on it, so I don't know exactly what was founded from there. And then they also tried to write me up saying that I was outside of the branch screaming at bankers through the window, and I'm like, no, that never happened. And that I walk around with no shoes on, like, just silly things like that, like anything they could pull out of their head just to write somebody up for. So I refused to sign all of the write-ups. Okay, I'm not signing any of them. I'd already intended to quit. You know, I was in the process of looking for another job. And I was just like, whatever. I just walked away. So a couple of days goes by, and I get a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning from the branch manager that's supposed to be out on FMLA, and she was telling me that an alarm had been triggered at the branch and that the cops were on their way there and that I had to go there. And I was like, okay. So I get up to meet the police officers at the branch. I drive all the way out there, and I live about 25-minute drive away. I live in Virginia Beach, and the branch was in Chesapeake. So I drive all the way over there, and I'm sitting in the parking lot, and I wait in an hour, and there was no cops. No cops ever showed up. No alarm was ever pulled. So I was just like, oh, thanks. This is a really cute way to, you know, get at somebody.
So I reported that to HR, and HR was just like, well, it could have been an accident or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. You know, because at this point, I'm just shaking my head. I'm like, this is just insane. So I had a teller who was supposed to be going for a job interview at another branch because I told my tellers I was leaving. I told my tellers, you know, I'm looking for another job. I'm getting out of here because this is just too much. So a lot of them were also looking for other positions throughout the company. So one of my best tellers, a very sweet kid. I'm still friends with him, actually, too. He's a very nice guy. He doesn't work for the bank anymore. He quit. So it got quiet for a couple of days, which actually kind of scared me because I was so used to all the hype and drama. I mean, like, the district manager would call me all the time saying that I was talking about her behind her back to managers in other states, and I'm like, I haven't even called anyone. But when it got quiet, I knew something was happening. So November 9th of 2013, and this is literally 2 months after I started working in this branch, the district manager comes in, and she put herself in an empty office, and she was in there for quite a while, and I was working as a teller in the drive-thru. So she comes into the drive-thru and tells me that I need somebody to cover the drive-thru because she had somebody on the phone to talk to me. And I go into the office, and she closes the door, and she left and closed the door. Well, on the phone was a Wells Fargo investigator. So this woman gets on the phone, and the first thing that comes out of her mouth is, like, all these, like, federal laws and stuff and how it's illegal to do things. And I'm just sitting there like, I have no clue what she's talking about. He sends me an email that has a log on it that they were trying to say I forged someone else's signature on. It was somebody's initials. And it wasn't even in my handwriting, obviously. And it was really funny, like, ironic, the whole thing, because at first they were yelling at me for not doing logs, and now they're trying to say that I forged someone else's initials on a log. It was just like, okay, if that's the best you can do, fine. So she emails me a copy of this document, and it wasn't my handwriting, and I tell her, I'm like, look, that's not my handwriting. I was like, I did not do this. I haven't seen this log. I'm like, this definitely wasn't something that I did. And she goes, well, yeah, I guess that would be, you know, hearsay. She goes, but now I want to know why your cash box was short on October 16th. I was on vacation on October 16th. And that was the day that they had come in and did the dual audit on my cash box, the branch manager and somebody else. I think it was a banker. And they marked my cash box as being short, $62, and they approved a shortage. So she was like, well, you can be fired for your cash box being short and all this stuff. And I was like, well, ma'am, I was on vacation that day. I wasn't even here. And that cash audit was done by two different individuals. And she was like, well, it's still done with your cash. And if your cash was short, then it was short. And then I reminded her that Wells Fargo policy is any cash shortage under $100, you cannot be terminated for. You just get a write-up for. She was like, yeah, well, that's also hearsay. As of this point, you are terminated. Well, no, she said that I was on administrative leave. So I was like, okay. So I turned in my keys because, you know, the district manager was there as well as the MSC. And I'm like, look, I know she put me on administrative leave, but I'm not coming back. I'm like, I'm done. Whatever little game you guys are playing, you won. I'm over it. You know, here's my keys. Have a nice day. You know, and I grabbed my stuff from behind my cash bag. You know, I left my cash box there, but I grabbed, like, my jacket, and I had an umbrella with me because it was raining that day. And I grabbed my stuff and said goodbye to everybody and left. A day later, the district manager tried calling me, and she was calling and calling and calling, and I wasn't sure what she wanted. So I answered the phone, and I said, Sue, as of this point, I no longer work for Wells Fargo, and any further attempts for you to try to contact me are going to be considered harassment, so I would just suggest you leave me alone. And I hung up on her. A week later, I get a letter in the mail saying that I was terminated from Wells Fargo for falsification of bank record, and I was just like, wow, this is really funny, like, really funny. So, yeah, they were able to block me from getting unemployment, which was even better. I had to go to New Jersey Unemployment Appeal Court to get my unemployment reinstated. They tried to tell the state of New Jersey that I stole money out of an ATM, and I was just like, that's ridiculous. Like, why wasn't I arrested if I supposedly stole money? And then they weren't even able to supply the judge with any kind of proof that there was any money missing whatsoever from any of the ATMs in the branch. So Wells Fargo got fined from New Jersey Unemployment for lying and saying that I stole money when I obviously didn't. And then by the time all of that was cleared up and I was supposed to start receiving unemployment, I already found another job. So I never got any unemployment whatsoever after I left Wells Fargo. So, yeah, it was just like the last kick in the gut, you know? Like, they still just won't leave me alone. And I'm not the only person this happened to. There was numerous people across the United States who had essentially contacted Ethics to say that they saw something or heard something or witnessed something that was inappropriate and ended up getting fired for doing so, because they really will go out of their way to harass you and to do what they feel necessary to get rid of you. You know, I had even overheard a banker, and this happened in my branch, and I overheard the whole conversation. One of the bankers had offered a teller $50 to set up a renter's insurance account for 1 month. She even said, she goes, just leave it open for a month so I can get my bonus and then I'll close it. She's like, I'll give you $50 and I'll pay for the renter's insurance. And I reported that to Ethics, and she was just given like a slap on the wrist for it. You know, it was just really bad. You know, they turned a blind eye to anything that was wrong if it caused them to get a bigger bonus check. And that's ultimately what it was all about, was just getting that bigger bonus check. The Wells Fargo shareholders were expecting us to always have so many sales, and everything was considered a sale. A checking account, a savings account, you know, a student credit card, a major credit card, home equity lines of credit, personal lines of credit, all of that got somebody a bonus. And the more of it you got in, the bigger the bonus everybody else got. A banker would only get maybe a $5,000 bonus, but a district manager who had successful bankers can end up with like a $20,000 bonus. And the regional manager would get a $50,000 bonus. And, you know, it just went uphill from there. So all the stress and pressure for people to do bad things came from the top, because they wanted those $50,000 bonuses, and the branch managers wanted $10,000 bonuses, and they couldn't get them if the bankers weren't performing. So I can honestly say that there was bankers who refused to do bad things, who were threatened or told that they had to stay at work and make phone calls till 8, 9 o'clock at night to try to get more sales, or go walk around the mall and pressure people into opening accounts at the mall. You know, it was ugly. Like, the sales tactics were completely ridiculous. And a lot of the bankers were fine with it. You know, they would open up fake accounts. They would wait for somebody to come in, and, you know, because the second you open up a profile for a customer and you put in that social security number, a background, a credit check is done. And there's a recommendations page that pops up that'll tell you, hey, this person's got great credit. You know, they're pre-approved for this credit card and this personal line of credit, and you have to push those items. And if the customer says no, you're just supposed to put not at this time. But what a lot of people would do is, if the customer said no, they would write down the person's social security number, wait for that person to leave, open up a whole new profile with the same social, this way the recommendation screen pops up again, and hit yes to both items, and have everything linked to the branch address, so that credit card that was ordered under your social ended up at the branch. You know, some of the credit cards were used. They weren't just thrown away. Some people actually used those credit cards to buy lunch. I mean, there was tellers who were driving BMWs. They didn't get that from working at Wells Fargo, because tellers only made $11-$12 an hour. You know, like, a lot of this money was stolen. It was being liquidated, and everybody turned a blind eye to it because everybody was getting bonuses. So nobody cared. I reported 3 home equity lines of credit that were held against properties that the owners of the property didn't even know existed. And Ethics was just like, okay, yeah, we'll delete them. Okay, well, you'll delete them, but that credit, like, that person's credit is still tarnished by this, because now there's a HELOC open on a property that they own. It might not be a big property. It might just be like a vacation home or something, but that's still their home that somebody opened the home equity line of credit for under their social with someone else's name and the branch address as the home address, and nobody seems to care. It was really sad. You know, customers would come in all the time saying, hey, I got this credit card in the mail. I never wanted a credit card. And all we were told to say was, oh, it must have been sent by accident. I'll go ahead and shred that for you. It was just all thrown into the wind. Like, nobody cared. You got high fives for opening up 10 credit cards a week. Whether the people wanted them or not, didn't matter. Reporting that got us nowhere. You know, if you reported it, you weren't a team player. You know, if you reported it. And if you weren't a team player, you had to go. And that's basically the position I ended up in, you know, where in New Jersey, it didn't work that way because New Jersey was pilot state. Our sales goals were completely different in New Jersey. Our sales goals wasn't based on how many accounts we opened. It was how much money was in those accounts. You know, if somebody came in and opened up 6 regular checking accounts, that did nothing for us if they didn't have money in them. In New Jersey, we didn't have to worry about none of that. But in Virginia, they still are operating under the old system where it was quantity over quality. And that's what got a lot of people to do things that they shouldn't have been doing. And reporting it is what got a lot of people fired. My lawsuit is about them. It's actually, I'm in with the class action lawsuit that the lawyers have set up for all the people who retaliated against after they reported unethical behavior to Wells Fargo Ethics. I wasn't the only one who reported it and got fired. You know, there was a lead teller who worked in the branch down the street from mine, and me and her were good friends, and she also got fired for reporting things. And when they came out to do their investigation, they fired, like, 2 branch managers, and none of the bankers who did any of this stuff got fired because they were all told, just don't do it again. You know, they made the branch managers look bad and made it look like they were all their fault and kept the bankers. Just really sad. Like, I'm happy they got caught. Not because I'm not trying to make any money off of it. I'm really not. Because what's done is done. I just feel like I'm finally getting some kind of justification for everything that I went through. You know, in 2 short months, I'm finally being justified for those 2 short months that I was even in there. Even my old branch manager wrote me a really good letter of recommendation before I even moved down here. And I reminded, like, HR about that when they were trying to agree with the district manager and saying that I was causing trouble. I'm like, you know, I worked for this company for 8 years and had never been written up. I've been promoted 7 times in 8 years and was never written up. And now all of a sudden in 2 short months, I'm a horrible person. Like, it doesn't work that way. I've always had a very great work ethic. In fact, since I left there, I've been working for the same job since. And I've been promoted 3 times in 4 years. So I'm not a horrible employee. And I know I was an asset to the company. But they decided to throw that away with a bunch of craziness. So, you know, I'm just happy they got caught. And I hope that all the bankers and all the district managers and the regional managers who were in on it, who knew about it, who knew that they were firing, like literally getting rid of people for doing the right thing and keeping people for doing the wrong thing, I hope they all get terminated. I really do. Because they were the issue. Right now I work for a car dealership. I actually buy cars from auctions so that they could be resold on the lot. When I first started working there, I just worked in the cash room. And I was just doing cash audit at the dealership. And then I was working as the service manager. And then I was working in parts. And now I buy cars from auction. So I do DXing. So, you know, I'm doing really good. I'll never work in another bank again. I'm completely over banking. I don't even want a bank account. Like, I'm done. Like, I want nothing to do with the banking industry. But when this all happened, it was very detrimental because me and my daughter, I'm a single mom. You know, me and my daughter had just moved down here from New Jersey. Within 2 months of me moving down here, I lost a really good paying job. I was making $25 an hour at Wells Fargo. I was getting paid very well. And I flew through my savings account just trying to keep our apartment, you know, and I claimed bankruptcy. We just about became homeless, you know, if it wasn't, my brother wasn't going to let us be homeless, but, you know, if I didn't have family living down here, who's to say me and my daughter wouldn't become homeless? You know, my car got repossessed. I was behind like $300 on the electric bill. Like it got really ugly like that first year after I left because I didn't know anybody down here. I didn't have any networking available to me to get me a good paying job. So I ended up working at a car dealership in the cash audit room, which only paid $11 an hour. And when your rent is almost $1,000 a month and you're on a lease, you can't just leave, you know, it was a very hard time. You know, me and my daughter went through a very, very hard time. But now we're doing good. You know, I own my home. I have a car. Like, we're doing fine now. But that year, I mean, it was a very rough year. And part of me, I hate that it happened, but I don't regret it because all that builds character. So it's okay. But it was a very rough year, and none of it needed to happen. And if anything, I just regret coming down here. I should have just stayed in New Jersey because I'd probably still be working for Wells Fargo today.
Tim, we've listened to Lynn's experience. You work for yourself. You have your own business. You're a freelancer, so you don't have to necessarily deal with the pressures of like these corporate structures. But could you empathize with what she was going through?
Yeah, trying to just use empathy in any situation, and this is, you know, with what having to deal with her bosses and the her higher ups or her supervisors. Which I've never worked at a bank, but from how she describes it, I mean, that had to have been a really terrible situation, especially with all the harassing.
Right. And, you know, you think about the stages of her process. Like, you know, she was shocked to find out what they were doing at the bank. She goes through all the proper channels to try to report it. And then when she does, she's harassed. I mean, so much so you can't even mourn a family member at a memorial service without work calling you. And I think that you could tell that she was a very good employee, dedicated to her job, did a good job at her job. But people didn't want her to expose what was going on. And just to think that her boss said, I didn't ask you to move down here to cause all this trouble. Just business as usual, you know?
No.
And that's sad. How do we ever improve?
All the bankers are just, they're making hand over fist on this whole thing that they're doing. And somebody to come in and just, and to screw that up for them. Yeah, you know, they just want to, you know, throw them under the bus as quick as possible.
You know, Tim, I'd love for just to add to this episode a piece from Senator Elizabeth Warren's testimony when she was talking to the former Wells Fargo CEO. I mean, she let him have it. And I'd love for the listeners to hear a little clip of just how she questioned him about his role. So if we could take a listen to that, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stumpf, the Wells Fargo vision and values statement, which you frequently cite, says, quote, "We believe in values live, not phrases memorized. If you want to find out how strong a company's ethics are, don't listen to what its people say. Watch what they do." So let's do that. Since this massive years-long scam came to light, you have said repeatedly, quote, "I am accountable." But what have you actually done to hold yourself accountable? Have you resigned as CEO or chairman of Wells Fargo?
The board, I serve at
the... Have you resigned?
No, I've not.
All right. Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars that you were paid while this scam was going on?
Well, first of all, this was by 1% of our people.
Not my question. My question, this is about responsibility. Have you returned one nickel of the millions of dollars that you were paid while this scam was going on?
The board will take care
of that. Have you returned one nickel of the money you earned while this scam was going on?
And the board will do...
I will take that as a no, then. Have you fired a single senior executive? And by that, I don't mean a regional manager or branch manager. I'm asking about the people who actually led your community banking division or your compliance division.
We've made a change in our regional to lead our regional bank.
I just said, I'm not asking about regional managers. I'm not asking about branch managers. I'm asking if you have fired senior management, the people who actually led community banking division, who oversaw this fraud, or the compliance division that was in charge of making sure that the bank complied with the law.
Carrie Toll said...
Did you fire
any
of those people? No. Okay. So you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves. It's gutless leadership. In your time as chairman and CEO, Wells has been famous for cross-selling, which is pushing existing customers to open more accounts.
That is so frustrating to listen to. The guy is so dishonest, he can't even answer a question properly, and he can't, just like she said, gutless. I mean, the guy is completely gutless. They're so greedy, they can't even behave like a true human being anymore. And so at the beginning of this episode, we also had three clips of Trump talking about deregulation and how regulations have been hurting the economy and hurting the job market and whatnot.
And to think, after just hearing President Trump saying what he said, where are we going to be? If we're going to have less regulation, is there going to be another Wells Fargo 3 to 5 years from now? My goodness. My goodness. I mean, you think about why we establish rules. If we didn't have a speed limit, would everybody just drive at a safe level? Do you think? You know, you have to think we all need to be governed by something. And even with being governed, we still break rules and do things bad. But we have to have some standard.
Yeah, people, the law enforcement, ordinary people every day get in trouble for such little petty mistakes. And then you have huge multi-million, billion-dollar corporations that can completely screw up a number of people all at one time and while making themselves money, and nothing happens. The government doesn't care.
Something's got to change, man. Something's got to change. And hopefully something will happen to your student loan. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. And thank you so much, Lynn, for your bravery to come forward and share your story. And, you know, hopefully if there's anybody else out there that's experiencing something similar, reach out to us and share your story with us. And maybe we can help at least spread the word as to how employees are really dealing with this internal pressure. But it's always good to tell the truth. Don't get involved, because even that could come back and bite you. So look for us. Like us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter at Nothing But The Truth Podcast. Shoot us an email if you like what you're hearing at
NBTT Podcast.
All right. Until next week, we will see you. But I do want to make a plug. All the Queen's Horses, my award-winning documentary, and my brilliant sound engineer on my documentary, Tim. I want to let you know that the All the Queen's Horses documentary will be at the Beloit International Film Festival, screening March 1st and 3rd. So if you are in Beloit, Wisconsin, join us. We are also going back to Dixon on March 3rd as well. And so join us there, either in Dixon in the afternoon, or in Beloit, Wisconsin on March 1st and 3rd. And those screening times are at 7:30. But if you Google Beloit International Film Festival and All the Queen's Horses, you will find location and time. So hope to see you there.
And just one last thing is that we did all the Queen's Horses screened at the Gene Siskel Theater. And also just recently at Harvard Kennedy School in Boston, yeah, Cambridge. And we have a couple Q&As that we'll be putting up on the podcast here soon. If you enjoy the podcast, go to the iTunes store and give us a rating. The best rating if possible.
Yeah, the best rating if possible. And thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.